Today's show is sponsored by Datadog, a cloud-scale monitoring platform built by engineers for engineers. Get end-to-end visibility into the health and performance of your infrastructure and applications. Use their log patterns to view and investigate unusual trends in logs and explore the service map to understand the hidden relationships between your services. You can start a free 14-day trial of Datadog and get a free t-shirt. To learn more, go to bit.ly.com/datadogshirt. That's bit.ly.com/datadogshirt. Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes, and today I'm talking with Dr. Molly Peoples. She is an associate astronomer at the Space Telescope Science Institute, and she's Astronomolly on Twitter. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
You're doing all kinds of stuff, and I'm just enjoying reading about it. I started at molly.science. Kudos for the .science top-level domain. That's pretty amazing. Yes, very nice, very nice. And I just got lost in the all the stuff online that you're doing around that that interface of theory and data. And you're working on Hubble right now?
Yes.
So how does that work? This was launched in 1990. This is how old now? It's a 30-year-old telescope.
We are coming up on the 29th birthday of it, April. It's still going strong. The last servicing mission was in 2009, where they installed two new instruments and repaired two others. And we're still getting groundbreaking science from it.
Really? Seriously? Like, this is, not to put a too fine a point on it, but my Apple Watch has more processing power, does it not?
Yeah.
So how is this old thing still producing amazing stuff? Is it really about the physicality of the mirrors and the telescope itself and not about the processing power?
Yeah, that's the main thing. You know, we do the most of the processing of the data here on the ground. So the two main things are that it is the Hubble Space Telescope. So it's in space. It's above the atmosphere of the Earth. And so it's able... It doesn't have to look through all of the air that's in the atmosphere, and so it can get amazingly crisp pictures. And the part that I find particularly relevant for my science is a lot of my science requires the ultraviolet, and you can either have UV astronomy from the ground or life on Earth. So we put our UV instruments up in space.
Okay, so then if the atmosphere, the atmosphere of the Earth is absorbing or blocking all these different wavelengths, is the Hubble above it all or above the important parts?
It's above most of it. Hubble's in a very weird orbit because it had to be accessible by the space shuttle in order to do these servicing missions. So it's above the vast majority of the atmosphere, but there is still little wisps of it up there, which is why some of the future observatories and some current ones now are going out to beyond the orbit of the moon, where you really don't have to worry about anything from the Earth's atmosphere anymore. But it's harder to get to if you want to fix.
Okay, well, 350 miles up is a non-trivial amount of way up, isn't it?
Yeah, but I mean, that's closer. I'm sitting here in Baltimore. That's closer than I am to Boston right now. So,
no, that's a good point.
It's closer than you think.
Yeah, it is closer than you think. So what is it sending down and in what way? Like, is this just a stream of text that we can listen to? Can someone with a software-defined radio or their own thing, like as it passes by, can we catch what Hubble's spitting out?
I'm not actually sure. I know it, I'm pretty sure it goes through the Deep Space Network, but I'm not actually sure of the details of like how the raw packets are sent down. But they're definitely different levels, and then they get repackaged at the Goddard Space Flight Center and sent to Space Telescope for final processing.
Okay. So this is the Deep Space Network is this worldwide network of like catching everything that's coming back from space and then processing it. And then when you wake up and go to work in the morning, how do you consume this data? Do you go to a website or is it sitting in a file somewhere?
So I basically don't consume the data because I'm primarily a theorist. But the way that one would do it is it takes very few hours to go from the data being taken on orbit to being delivered to the online archives that we host here at Space Telescope. Mm-hmm. It's called MAST. It used to be the Multi-Mission Archive for Space Telescopes, but we renamed it the Mikulski Archive for Space Telescopes because Senator Mikulski was such a huge advocate for the Hubble Space Telescope, for the idea of democratizing science through archived data. And yeah, it can take just a few hours to go from having the data just be taken and it's online, ready to be downloaded and looked at.
That's really interesting. That makes me realize, though, that this isn't like hidden from us, right? If you want the data, if you're an enthusiast, if you're listening to this podcast, you don't have to have special top secret access. This is just science and it's out there for people to consume.
Yeah, it's all out there. Just go to mast.stsci.edu. Most of the data we have is from Hubble, but there are many other space telescopes. We even have some data from ground-based observatories that are there that can be, we have quick look pages and ways to easily access it. And we also do a lot of developing of tools for people to, once they download the data, to be able to process that data and analyze it to try to lower the bar for access for people.
Mm-hmm. Now, when I asked the question about how you consumed it, you said that you're a theorist, but you kind of also are, you live between that world of theory and that world of data. Maybe you can help me understand the roles of people that, what do you do as a theorist and how does that relate to someone who might be consuming the raw data and where does that interface?
Yeah. So, I mean, the easy reason why I got into theory originally is most astronomy, of course, requires going to physical telescope and staying up all night. And so I joke that I like sleeping at night, which is why I like either theory or, you know, my telescopes to be in space. What I do is run simulations of the universe and where I actually know what's going on. So for example, if you take a picture of a galaxy with Hubble, it's beautiful, but it's also a huge mess. And you want to know things like, how quickly is this galaxy forming stars? How far away is this galaxy? How old is this galaxy? How much gas does this galaxy have? Things like that. And instead, what you get are a bunch of photons that have different wavelengths and different positions on your detector. And somehow you want to answer all of those questions, you know, based on that distribution of light. Whereas if I make a simulation, I know to start with, a priori, I know I can just measure in the simulation, well, I just formed this many stars in the last many million years, and therefore this is the rate I'm forming stars at. I can draw a sphere around my galaxy and say, ah, this is how much gas is in there. This is how many stars are in there. So what I like to do is create synthetic data from the simulations that look as much like the real data as possible, that I can then treat like the real data and use to interpret the real data. So I can, for example, say, if I make this measurement on the real data, am I actually measuring what I think I'm measuring? Is there a bias or systematic in that measurement that I'm not aware of? And if I get the measurement out from the simulation that I know is the underlying physical conditions, it's a lot easier to believe that measurement on the real data.
Does, and forgive my ignorance ahead of time, I've been at basically everything that I'm going to ask, but how does one avoid a kind of scientific confirmation bias where you convince yourself that something is so by working backwards? Are you just always questioning your assumptions?
Yeah, definitely. It's so one of the ways that people will often use simulations is to say, well, if I measure the same thing, like say the same distribution of galaxy masses in this simulation as I measure in the observations, then that must mean that whatever physical models I have in the simulation are correct. And that's where you can definitely run into confirmation bias. And I have definitely seen claims out there in the literature that, you know, say, oh, I made this, you know, we got this scaling relation correct and these galaxy properties correct, and therefore our models are correct. And you look at their models and you're like, yes, but your models are unphysical in the following five ways. What I prefer to do is turn the problem, look at it from the other side and say, well, if I'm able to make a universe that's close to realistic, that, you know, may not be perfect in the following, you know, 27 ways, but it's close enough to realistic that the data have, you know, that the statistical properties of the data are close enough that I can use it to test my measurement methods or inform my measurement methods on the real data, then that means that I can actually go out and make those measurements on the real data and learn about the real universe that way.
Okay. Are these, I presume these are tiny universes, or are these universes that you are simulating that are limited only by your compute and memory?
I mean, everything I do is limited by my compute and memory and hard drive space.
Aren't we all?
Yeah. So there are two kinds that we do for these kind of cosmological scale simulations. One is you pick some volume that's got, you know, hundreds, thousands of galaxies in it. And you start when the universe was very, very young, and you let it evolve, hopefully for 13 or 14 billion years until it gets to today. Or you say, oh, you know, the James Webb Space Telescope that's launching in a few years is going to be really good at looking at the early universe. And, you know, that just happens to only be a few billion years, you know, so it's a shorter amount of time that you have to let the computation run for. Or there you can make like a statistical measurement of all the galaxies everywhere in this volume. But the trade-off there is that you probably have not resolved those galaxies very well. So because you're spreading the computational power out everywhere in the whole volume. Mm-hmm. So you can do statistical things, but they may or may not actually be based on that good of data. The other thing you can do is say, well, there's this one galaxy that I really want to track its evolution for. And so I'm going to embed it in a full cosmological volume and get like the large scale gravity and the large scale gas flows that matter for the evolution of this one galaxy. And then I'm going to just pour all of my computational resources into really, really, really resolving the small scale structure of what that galaxy is doing through time. So I've been mostly doing the latter, but the general game is you kind of do both, and then you figure out what the differences are and try to bridge the gap to get the full statistical volume.
So this analogy may not work, but it feels to me like it's the cosmological equivalent of, if a galaxy falls in the woods, does it make a sound? You're focusing on the one you're looking at, and the ones that you're not looking at, you kind of elide, or you yada, yada, yada over those things.
Yeah, and it's basically because gravity is really nice like that, that on large scales, if you're very far away from something, you don't care about the small scale structure of what that thing is doing gravitationally. You just care about what the center of mass of that thing is doing. So you can resolve it in these, we call them zooms. When you're zooming in on a single galaxy, the stuff that is very, very far away from that galaxy, you don't have to add much computational power to in order to get the relevant parts of it from it correct.
Okay. So just like in a video game, when you get closer to something that's far away, the textures get more and more and more resolved, and you start to care. And by observing them, you care more, and that forces it to resolve itself.
Yeah.
Interesting. And how big are these things are we talking about? I mean, like, talk about it in the sense of compute and memory and where you find that you are limited.
Yeah. So they kind of range a lot. So actually the outputs that are refine everywhere, large volume, try to get the hundreds and thousands of galaxies. We have a bunch that we've been trying to move over from the Blue Water supercomputer to here in trying to copy those over from Illinois here in to Baltimore. And they're like 130 gigabytes each, which doesn't sound like much, but we have a few hundred of them. So, I mean, I think the total volume that we have at that one is about a petabyte. So we won't be able to keep all of the data. And so we have to kind of figure out, like, all right, which of these outputs are actually important? Do we actually want to keep long term? So I think we're going to probably just keep, like, you know, maybe about 100 terabytes of it. The smaller versions that we have, again, can really depend on how you do the resolution. So one way to think about it is for every, say, parcel of gas in the volume, you have a 3D position, a 3D velocity, a something that's tracking its composition basically. You have like a temperature and energy. So at the very least, you have, and I'm probably missing one of the relevant parameters, you have 8 parameters that you're trying to keep to, depending on how you ran it, double or float precision. So multiply a lot, and if you've got 10 to the 8 resolution elements, you're easily running, you know, 25 gigabytes per output for those. So the zooms can be a lot smaller, but they're still pretty meaty. And so if you're trying to do analysis on them, you really want a large RAM machine.
Mm-hmm. And I'm looking at the Blue Waters website here. And just to give folks that may not be familiar a little bit of context, it says more than a petabyte and a half of memory, 25 petabytes of disk storage, and 500 petabytes of tape storage. And this is just from a website a couple years old. So who knows if it's been beefed up since then. This is not just a fire up a few virtual machines in the cloud type of a problem that we're trying to solve here.
Yeah. And Blue Waters was actually slated to go offline in March. They've already got plans. Like it's old. It's on its way out. We actually got an email this week saying that they're going to keep it plugged in until December, which is very exciting. But it's definitely kind of the older generation.
Right.
Yeah.
So this is something that's quite a few years old, and now you're moving on to the next giant supercomputer.
Yeah, and unfortunately, the newer versions that are being made, they really like putting lots and lots of cores on a single node. And so for a fixed amount of memory per node, you end up with a lot less memory per core, which makes them very inefficient for these kinds of simulations. Which is very sad.
So what you care about more is about holding all these things in memory and processing on it. You're less interested in the parallelism.
Well, no, the parallelism is very important, but just with the given the architecture that is out there, we usually end up memory limited. So for example, the computer that I use the most is NASA's Pleiades computer. Mm-hmm. And it's got a bunch of different nodes to choose from, but it'll be, you know, about 128 gigabytes per node. So maybe 4 to 5 gigabytes per core. Depending on whether or not you have the hyper threading on, you know, it can be like, 28 to 32 cores. The new Stampede 2 machine that's at the Texas Computing Center, they have these nodes that are 68 cores per node and only have 96 gigabytes per node. So the RAM per core is like ridiculously small. And so you have to use a whole bunch of nodes in order to get up to the number of cores that you need to do the calculation in order to still have everything in memory. And it just all gets shot very quickly.
Yeah. I'm looking at the Pleiades website and the Stampede website, and it's very interesting. It's all about trade-offs. Like one of them has a quarter petabyte of memory and one of them's got upwards of a petabyte of memory, but then fewer cores and you go back and forth. One's got 500,000 cores, one has 250,000. Which one's the right for your problem?
Yeah. And a lot of it is also for a given piece of code, how well does it actually scale to lots and lots of cores? Mm-hmm. So the code that I actually use for my simulations is called Enzo, and it was originally written in 1996. And this is definitely the power of open source programming. It's one of the few cosmological simulation codes that's still going strong because many people have contributed to the code base over the years. But it just has a fundamental limitation that it just does not scale well to more than about 1,000 cores. The main developers of that code have completely started from scratch, hired an actual computer scientist who knows how to write code, and rewritten it in a language that's going to be better for scaling it to more cores. And we think that it'll actually be able to scale perfectly up to something the size of a Blue Waters, which will be very, very exciting. So that means that at a fixed resolution and amount of computing power, you can do that same thing, but over a much, much, much larger volume.
What is the name of the next thing beyond Enzo? Is it going to be Enzo version 2 or something else?
It's going to be Enzo E, where E is for exascale. It was called Enzo P for a while, but then it became more ambitious as we went from petascale to exascale.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's so interesting as a software engineer to hear about these entire worlds and entire projects that people depend on and they use every day and these problems that you're trying to solve. Well, a lot of us are just out here trying to get JavaScript to work on our shopping carts. It just puts everything into perspective. Hey, folks, you're a very good developer, probably. Regardless, you do write bugs. That's unavoidable. What is avoidable is wasting time trying to track down the cause of those bugs. Sentry.io provides full-stack error tracking that lets you monitor and fix problems in real time. You can see the severity and the scope of the error, get immediate access to the stack trace, connect the problem to the commit that caused it, and fix it without delay. Sentry, it's a name so common that they have to include the top-level domain in their advertising to make sure you remember it. Sentry.io. That's Sentry.io. Open source, full stack, web apps, native apps, mobile games, smart oven mitts. If you can program it, they can make it far easier to fix any errors you encounter with it. Your code may be broken. Let's fix it together. Visit Sentry.io. I'm looking at some papers that you've written and some spaces that you explore, and I'm trying to understand what circumgalactic medium is.
Yeah, circumgalactic medium is awesome. It's like the most awesome thing you've never heard of. Yeah, so the way that a galaxy forms, so a galaxy like our Milky Way, right? Basically, what galaxies do is they turn gas into stars, right?
Okay,
and then stars like to blow up when they die, so they return a lot of that material back to the galaxy. Mm-hmm. That's the basic thing that galaxies spend all of their time doing, making stars and then stars dying and blowing up. Now, two pieces of that is, one, they have to get the gas from somewhere. They just don't have it to start with. Mm-hmm. And two, when these huge explosions go off, that material is usually not gravitationally bound to the galaxy. It's not going to stay in the galaxy. It's going to go outside of the galaxy. So the circumgalactic medium is what we call all of the gas that is roughly gravitationally bound to the dark matter halo that the galaxy resides in, but is not in the galactic disk itself. So it's not where the stars are. So to give you a sense of scale, we and the Earth are about 8 kiloparsecs away from the center of our galaxy. A kiloparsec is 1,000 parsecs. A parsec is 3.2 light years.
Okay.
The radius of the dark matter halo that we're living in is 300 kiloparsecs. Mm. So our galaxy is a very, very, very small fraction volumetrically of this entire volume. So the two things that we've known for a long time are that, one, most of the gas that you would expect to be in this dark matter halo is not in the galaxies. The galaxies are very inefficient at turning all of the gas that's in the halo into stars. Depending on the mass, the galaxy can be like from only 5 to 20% of that entire material is inside the galaxy. And two, this is the one I find much more interesting. So all of the elements on the periodic table that are heavier than helium were made in the death of a star. So all of the oxygen you're breathing right now, all of the carbon that's in your body, et cetera, was born in the death of a star.
So that idea that we're all just the stardust, that is like a real thing. That's not just a thing we say to be romantic.
That's very literal. Yes. No, it's like super, super literal. Now, the part that's really exciting about that, right, is definitionally stars are in galaxies. So stars die when they're in galaxies. So all of the heavy materials you would expect to be in the galaxies. But if you actually do the math and you do the accounting, the budgeting, you say, well, how many metals have I made? How many metals do I have? Astronomers are lazy and so call everything heavier than helium metals. How many of these heavy elements do I have? How many are still in the galaxies? Only about 20 to 25% of them are still in the galaxies. And so the exciting thing that we've been able to do with one of the ultraviolet spectrographs on Hubble in the last 10 years is actually point to where most of this gas and most of these heavy elements are in the circumgalactic medium outside of the galaxies. And it's very difficult to do because this gas is very, 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 very diffuse. So it does not generally emit light. To give you an idea of how diffuse it is, imagine a 1 meter cube space. There would be like one atom in that.
Oh, wow. That would be hard to see if I'm sitting in front of it.
Exactly. But luckily, space is really big. And so if you've got, you know, a huge path length to look for, what we can do is look at the signatures of background light that's passing through it and look at characteristic absorption of that background light to measure and quantify where this material is. So that's one of the reasons that we use a lot of the synthetic data, because the direct measurements are so difficult in the first place, that the simulations and the synthetic data can really help us figure out how to interpret those data in terms of the underlying physical properties.
How often one of your main tweets or your pinned tweets is talking about going back and forth in Slack with some of your colleagues and going, oh my goodness, look at this. Holy crap. Holy crap. That happens in the movies like every 20 minutes. Like, you know, the astronomer that the president always calls to, you know, to come and talk to the aliens usually gets to cool discovery several times. Are you going like days and like, oh my goodness, holy crap? Or is it weeks? How often do you get those like, oh my goodness, we just discovered this, or we just found that, or we just confirmed this?
I would say it depends on how excitable our group is.
Well, positive feedback is always good though.
Yeah, it is. So the thing that I and my group have been doing in the last 2 years that's very novel is usually in the simulations, what people will do is they'll put their computational power in the very dense regions. So in the galaxies where the stars are actually forming. And that makes sense if the observations you're trying to compare to are the pictures of the galaxies, the properties of the galaxies, the things that are easy to measure. And what we were coming to realize was, well, most of the volume and most of the material is not in those very dense regions. And that a lot of the activity that's happening is happening in these very low density regions that are further out. And so we created some new techniques for improving the spatial resolution in this very low density regime. So we were, you know, every time we look at these simulations, we see something new because we're using this new technique. And that can get very, every time, yeah. So every time we actually have a new plot that we make from those, we get very excited. and, you know, that from the observational point of view, if you're used to just looking at, you know, little squiggly lines from a spectrograph, mm-hmm. and then using your imagination to interpret what's going on in these large scale cosmic bubbles, it can be exciting to actually see those happening, you know, in an animated GIF on Slack.
It seems like the cosmological equivalent of like someone giving you like, you know, 5 pixels and then someone goes enhance and then you can see the license plate and you're like, oh my goodness, that's amazing. But you're actually doing that. You're really pulling.
Yeah. The analogy that my, one of my colleagues uses is, it's like, putting on a pair of reading glasses, but the actual the words that you're looking at have changed.
Whoa.
Yeah. Okay. So you have this picture that you expect at low resolution, but when you actually allow the physics that's happening at the smaller scales to do its thing, then, you know, the whole picture changes, which is very exciting. These take, you know, easily 10 times longer to run than some of the more standard simulations. So we understand why people haven't really tried to do this before.
Mm-hmm. We joke sometimes as programmers that, you know, there's a lot of time where we just like go to lunch and come back to see if the compile has finished. When you run simulations, like how much of it is just like hanging out, waiting for the thing to go? And like, are these things taking months or how long does it take for these?
Oh, all of it. I mean, I have some runs that I started back in May that I really hope have made it the 14 billion years of cosmic history, maybe by this May, maybe not. they take months and months and months. Yeah.
What if you forget? Have you ever been like, oh, that run is done. What was I doing?
So I have and have not ever had that happen. The supercomputers are very good at emailing you when your job is finished. And so you kind of get in this pattern of Pleiades, the longest walk clock time you're allowed is 5 days. So you get very used to every 5 days, logging in, resubmitting all your jobs, going away again. And I've got mine on a script, so they back up automatically. So I don't even have to do that manually anymore. My favorite though was a simulation that, when we were just starting on this project, we asked a colleague to run for us. And like 2 years later, we were like, you know what? It'd be really nice if we had a simulation that whatever. And he's like, I ran that. It generated a petabyte of data. Would you like it? And we were like, yes. Because, you know, it had taken over a year to run, and we weren't the ones running it, so we'd completely forgotten about it.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, I've had a number of things like that where it'll come out of nowhere, and I'm like, oh, wow, what was I thinking? Where did I, you know, it's the, where did I put my keys kind of equivalent.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. So people can check you out at molly.science, and you're talking about science and life on Twitter as well. And as well on your website, you've got videos of public talks, your writing, and all these different kinds of things that you're doing, as well as you did Hubble Hangouts for a while as well, where you were talking publicly about how the science gets done.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Well, thanks so much for chatting with me today.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.